Welcome to Newsworthy with Norrisworthy. Get ready for some awesome.
Welcome back to the show, friends. Today we have our first ever interview in front of a live studio audience. This is a conversation that took place last week at an event that my good buddy Patrick Hunter Bills put on down in Dallas, an event called The Initiative, an event I would highly encourage you to put in your calendar for next October. It's a great resource for anyone who cares anything about preaching. So I got to talk with one of the special guest speakers, which was the Reverend Dr. Anna Carter Florence. She is a graduate of Yale University and Princeton Theological Seminary. Currently, she is teaching homiletics at Columbia Theological Seminary down in Georgia. She had a great sense of humor. She was a lot of fun to talk to, and she was very insightful. If you are not a big fan of preaching, though, I'm going to warn you, this might not be the show for you, and I apologize about that. But if you are a fan of preaching, I think you're going to enjoy this quick little interview that I did with Dr. Anna Carter Florence. And without further ado, here she is. Typically try to have a good time, talk to some people about some interesting things. And we have an interesting person right here. So let's do this.
Okay.
You ready?
I'm ready.
Okay. Now, last night, listened to your sermon. It was great. I did feel a little excluded, though.
Tell me.
You used sewing metaphor, cooking metaphor.
Okay, well, Luke, that's on you.
Did you think about using like a hunting or a football metaphor?
No.
Not at all?
Because that's not what was in the text.
It wasn't?
The word was sew, right? And they sewed fig leaves, yes? Okay, it wasn't that they got and went and shot fig leaves. But if that were in the text, then we'd be going there, too. So.
But if you midrash enough, you can get to football.
Okay, where are we going with this?
I never know. No, I really enjoyed it. And you said that you had never followed a comedian before. How'd that work out for you? Did you like it?
No.
No, not at all.
I felt for you all. I felt for everybody who's this our live audience here because
yeah, live audience.
It was late, so that was the main thing that I was feeling. But, yeah, following a comedian, well, I suppose, that'll be a good thing to go back and tell my students.
That's a good story you can tell.
It's a good story.
But if you think about it in our culture, when else do people sit in a room and listen to someone do a monologue for 40 minutes?
It's true.
Or 30 minutes. It's no other time.
It's true.
So it's, like, to me, it seems like there's something that we can learn from good comedians.
Good stand-up. Good improv. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, we do that, actually, I teach preaching at Columbia Seminary in Decatur, Georgia. It's a seminary affiliated with the Presbyterian Church. But we do, from time to time, get, I'm not sure we've had any Church of Christ. We get them in other degree programs. But we sometimes use improv as a teaching tool.
Mm-hmm. Your background was in drama. Did you ever do improv?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Along with your repertory
church. Yeah. Well, that's just the,
that was just a metaphor.
That's a metaphor.
But did you actually do that as well? Is that like a different kind of,
well, improv is, y'all know about improv, right? Am I allowed to address them?
No, they do not exist.
As you? Yeah.
It's just you and me.
Okay. Okay. Sorry, Luke.
Yeah.
Okay. So
this is all about me.
It is all about you. He's the subject. Okay. So, the great thing about improv is, as you know, is that your responsibility is always to say yes. It's not to close down. So you throw something at me, and I say yes, and I take it and go from there.
Yes, I do. Did I just get it?
Yeah. Well.
Okay. No.
Not really, Luke. But that's okay. It's it's when we're moving around the room, or you know, and I suddenly begin to. The key word is as if. I suddenly begin to relate to you as if I'm your 5-year-old daughter or whatever. And you have to
six.
Go with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's like you actually have a 6-year-old daughter. I just was just pulling a number out of the air.
I thought you were like a psychic.
No, I wasn't. So improv can be really helpful. And I teach a course at the seminary called Back to the Text every spring, in which the idea is that we pick a book of scripture. I pick a book of scripture. The students read everything in scholarship that we can about it. And then the function of the class is we get together once a week for 3 hours and we read through the whole book. And at the end of the semester, we perform it. So we don't preach from it. We just improv with the, I create sort of a different contextual scenario for how we're going to read it.
That's kind
of,
that's kind of scary to me. You perform it. Like, what if it's like, like Old Testament, do you have to kill people and stuff? Or what?
Well, we've done the book of Daniel, which was
I would not do
like
Judges
a big long acid trip.
Do you?
We haven't done Judges.
Do you put acid? Do you take that?
No, Luke. No, this is a metaphor.
I'm not good with metaphors.
No, so we did the book of Daniel, which has a lot of sort of hallucinatory imagery in it. It's apocalyptic, right? And we've done the book of Esther, which has a lot of violence and stuff, but also a lot of humor and a lot of parody and a lot of farce. So we've done Old Testament books. Mm-hmm. But even the Gospel of Mark, which we've also done, has a lot of violence in it.
That's true.
Yes, it is.
Do you have a favorite violent part of Mark?
A favorite violent part of Mark.
I'm wondering.
Well, the crucifixion sort of is this moment.
It's kind of a bit downer, though.
I suppose you could look at it that way. And mm-hmm. Mark, you know, we did the first ending of Mark where
everybody
walks away.
Did you do the stuff
with
the snakes? Because that's like the very end of Mark. Do you include that or you cut that out? Because I would leave that in if I was going to act, because that would be really fun to watch.
Well, you know, obviously I need to bring you back to Columbia and get you in my class, because you're gonna be the one who's going to create all the trouble in class. I can see this. Yeah.
Well, I would love to. Is that an invitation?
Anytime.
Is that a scholarship?
You come and talk to us, and we'll work it out. You would be fun to have.
You know, you would have to do some midrash with my GPA to give me that scholarship. So
I can imagine.
Okay. Last night, you followed a comedian, and improv obviously is a way to learn into preaching and performance. Now, one of the things that you notice differently about you and my good friend Barb Reb Brown Taylor is that you're both manuscript preachers.
Yes, we are.
And my friend Barb preached at my alma mater not too long ago. She did a great job. Manuscript. Everyone loved her. Now, you look at comedians; they're not allowed to have anything on stage.
Yeah, it's true.
So, do you think a comedian could do a manuscript bit and it would work?
Well, you're talking different genres. I mean, I think I don't teach my students one way or the other to be a manuscript preacher or not. I think it depends on the kind of person you are, how you learn, how you think. What I always know is that whatever you take up there into the pulpit or up onto the stage is just it's a prompt. You know, it's something it's not supposed to be a barrier between you and the audience. Improv is actually, it looks like the person is just riffing, but it's very scripted. People have worked very hard. I mean, I've watched a lot of Robin Williams in the last months after his death, because he's one of the most brilliant improv people. But if you watch him if you go to YouTube and look up his riff on golf, you know, The Great American Game. Have you all seen that one? You can see him do it in a number of contexts, and it's actually pretty much the same each time that he does it. And what that says to me is that he's worked very, very hard.
To make it look like he's riffing.
Well, he's rehearsed it. And to look that natural is difficult, you know, but it's part of his genius.
I had a preaching professor in college. I'm not going to say his name because
he's in the room. Mm-hmm.
But he has this bit where he tries to think of something. He's like, well, how do you say this? And then he already has it memorized, but he's trying to make it look like he's riffing. Is that the same kind of idea?
I don't want to speak for your preaching professor. But I know as a teacher, I've got, you know, things that I've said a number of times. So,
mm-hmm. Okay. You know, it's weird though, at my church, which we are very serious, as you can imagine. If I don't have notes on there, people come up and say stuff like, Luke, that was really from the heart. And it really felt like you were speaking from your heart. But if I'm behind notes, they don't have that same response. Why do you think people say that kind of stuff?
Well, I think it probably has to do with you.
Well, typically, I think everything has to do with me. So
yeah,
we're on the same page.
As we've already noted, right. Probably, when you are using notes, I would guess that you're either very, that they're more of a barrier to you, so that people notice that.
Mm-hmm.
Or it may be that people just relate to... I think we were talking about this yesterday in the delivery class, that sometimes if you're speaking in a very passionate way, people interpret that as from the heart,
mm-hmm.
when it's really not necessarily the content of what's being said, but it is coming from a place of more emotion.
Yeah.
So
What do you think determines, like you said, it's about the personality, like one's a manuscript, one's not a manuscript. It just, it's their own personality being fleshed out.
I think it's how we learn. Yeah. Some people are, I taught with a colleague for 10 years, Chuck Campbell, who teaches now at Duke Divinity School. And he for his first 6 years in ministry was a manuscript preacher and then realized that it was getting in the way. And so he taught himself after 6 years to become a notes preacher. I have other students who can't even bring notes up because it gets too much in the way. Others just would do well with an outline, and some really do fine with a manuscript. My background was theater, and so I know how to work with a script. And so for me, a manuscript is not something I feel glued to. So
that's why that works
for me.
How does an actor work with a script? Is there some tips that I could learn? Hand gestures?
I don't do
jazz
that kind
fingers?
Of stuff. Who is this guy? no, I mean, I think those are the sorts of things that I don't recommend rehearsing that kind of stuff in the same way. I mean, maybe some people are able to rehearse gestures, and I was never, I never went to Juilliard or did that kind of thing where they would really work with you on all of that stuff. But for me, a script is, I spend most of my time with the text and, working on memorizing the text rather than my sermon, because I'm more interested in spending the time there. And then the sermon I write as if it's me speaking. Actually last night was really more of a lecture for me than a sermon. So it was not so, I mean, it was my language, but it was also not really, when I'm preaching, I use more, oral language. And so then when I'm with people, it doesn't feel like I'm having to translate. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, let's talk about the text. Now,
yes,
part
sir.
Of your, I'm not going to say a sermon, I'm going to say a lecture now, because that's what you said.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
It's not all about me, it's about you. Now, yeah. You said that you want to set the text free. So we're setting the text free. But I've heard some of my friends in here make comments about our churches don't really know the Bible too well. And mm-hmm. People say things like churches that are biblically illiterate, which is too big of a word for me to use, but I'm sure that means something. Mm-hmm. And they say that like churches don't understand the Bible. So if we want to go in there and just throw them into the refrigerator, metaphorically speaking, of course, but they don't know the Bible and people are biblically illiterate, do you think that might be kind of like a recipe for disaster?
I can see you've worked hard on those metaphors too.
Thank you.
Very good.
Thank you.
Well, again, I think what I was trying to say was, and you're getting at this too, that to not have a sense of how to work with the text is a little bit like walking into a refrigerator, opening it up and seeing all this food in a whole state and not knowing what to do with it, right? So your whole thing about not knowing how to cook. I have two sons who are 19 and 23. And one of the things I did early on was to teach them how to cook, because...
What'd you teach them?
Everything, man. I mean... I want them to know, you know, and not only do I want them to be able to fend for themselves, but I don't want them to be so dependent on me that they're going to, you know.
Be 33 in podcasts and talking about how they don't know how to cook.
Right, right.
Yeah, you don't
exactly,
want that,
which would be a sad thing.
Yeah,
so,
it would be if that was someone for real.
So, yeah.
Okay, but you use the language of aiming for truth versus innovation. And can you kind of flesh that? What does that mean to, because... I feel like if we're choosing truth or innovation, Jesus never said, I am the way and the innovation in the life. You know, he said, I am the way and the truth in life. So
it's true.
It seems like, isn't that the right one? But you seem to be pointing for innovation and an artistic reading that doesn't burn the text.
I think what I was trying to say was that it is true that what we're aiming for is truth and not just innovation for the sake of innovation.
Okay.
Okay. That's what I was trying to say. That when you approach scripture as art, as we were kind of doing today in the exercises that we were doing, in that we were giving ourselves some freedom to move around in it before we were going to say something about it. We were giving ourselves some time to rehearse it, to midrash it, to use that word. And then what you're looking for is those moments that you know are truthful. And when you have those moments, we talked about it as what is the moment in the text that's getting you. Then you can begin to flesh out something truthful to say. And to me, that's a more interesting journey than just to look for something that's new to say.
Yeah.
Truth is something you can depend on. It comes in every context. It comes in every time. It comes in every place. It comes in different forms, but that's what you're looking for.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's a tendency for us as preachers to want to get up and say something new every Sunday and to have people come up to us and say, I never thought of it that way. Because that's a great pat on the back, because it means we've done our homework and we're prepared and we've done some work. But there obviously is a downside to doing that, because there has to be something that is true, you know, in there.
Yeah.
And you talk about when you find that moment that is truthful, what helps you know that that is a truthful moment and not just an innovation that I want to go with?
That's a great question. And I think it's one that you need help with, because each of us who preach, you know, all of us who preach know these moments when what seems like a totally cool thing for us to say about the text really is, in the end, not a very truthful thing. It really has just been about saying something new or interesting.
Do you have an example, maybe a time that you did that?
I have a lot of times that I've done that, but I can't think of one right at this moment. But well, actually, I can think of one. I remember when I was a new preacher, sometimes as I was working on the text, I would mistake the things that had led to the sermon as things that really needed to be in the sermon. So, for example, I would be working with a text, and maybe I'd be listening to a song from U2. This is like 20 years ago, right? 25 years ago. And I would think that now, because that song, which had been playing, had been moving me, I really needed to quote the text, the words of that song, which would be totally lost in the moment of the sermon. They were pieces that would get me to the sermon, but they didn't need to be in it. And I made that, you know, that happened a lot when
I did that with the Taylor Swift song 2 weeks ago. Well, same thing.
I'm very sorry.
Yeah, it just happens to the best of us, though. Now, you talked about setting the text free in our church, okay?
Yeah.
Now, I get that in a safe environment like this, because these are all educated women and men who know the text, who, you know, went to school and whatever. But you go to the church, set it free. I'm interested in what that looks like, because you kind of had a little throwaway comment in which you, I don't know if it was disdain for small groups, but it was not a glowing affirmation of small groups in your comment last night. Or did I misunderstand that?
Oh, I didn't mean to be demeaning, so my apologies if it sounded like that.
Apology accepted.
Okay, thank you. So I do think that some of what I've been talking about really does need to happen in small groups outside of worship. Very much so. I think that we need to create some different kinds of spaces around. I mean, this is why people who go to youth, my kids who go to youth group and have a great experience there, sometimes have a hard time transitioning.
Yeah.
Because in youth group, you get to work with the text, you get to rehearse the text, you get to do all these fun things that you don't necessarily get to do in worship. I mean, I think youth ministry is one of the best places for doing this kind of stuff. And I think we just need to create more spaces like that for adults, or even better, mixed age groups.
Yeah, intergenerational. Have you seen like examples of that? Like, obviously you're Presbyterian.
Oh, sure.
So what are some examples of ways that you guys do that?
Well, I think it depends on the congregation, but, I can say a couple years ago, I led a retreat at a big, Presbyterian church in Memphis, and it was an elder retreat and deacons. So it was officers, church officers. And we just played around with the text like we've been doing here for the entire weekend, to a couple of different texts. And it was an amazing experience, because none of the people in the room, even though they were all officers, would necessarily have chosen to be in a small group together. But something happened in the room over a sense of trust and real appreciation for one another. And we were ages probably 16 to 80 plus. You know, there were maybe 60 people. It was great. And I remember, and when the retreat was over, they were saying, we really want to get together this way, not just to make decisions about the church, you know, which is going to be their official job, but we really want to get together to do this kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So,
okay. So every pastor has had someone come up to them and say, I really liked your sermon. And maybe you preach to say like Jesus is the bread of life. And they come up and say this obscure comment that has nothing to do with your sermon about the bread. Like, I'm glad to know the Bible's for a gluten-free diet. You know, like I didn't say that, but thank you. I'm gluten happy for you. But so there's like this fear that like you say something and the best way you can describe it is say, well, that's midrash. Okay. Or you can say, that's just crazy talk. Okay. And so we want to set the text free and we want people to embody and live into the text, but we don't want crazy talk.
Yeah.
And so are there ways that we can kind of like say, here's kind of context and here's what's going on and here's what it was like in, you know, this time. And maybe this was what's going on with authorial intent, But still be like, give him the bike, but give him training wheels, you know?
Yeah. So you're talking about boundaries.
Yes. Yeah. Boundaries are very healthy.
Yeah, they are. And you got to have boundaries. Let me put it this way. I think in a tradition like Church of Christ and a tradition like my tribe, which is the Presbyterian Church USA, we, our sort of interpretive task, our interpretive growing edge is not to be less free. We've had our pastors have had the incredible privilege of theological education, right? And that is a privilege. Not everybody gets that. And ministers who know a lot, people who are used to having a lot of really great, theological depth in their sermons. And so for us, the task is to kind of loosen up a little bit more. If I was coming to talk to a group, which, was kind of, I don't want to get specific, by naming different traditions, but
they won't hear this.
Well, for instance, my sisters and brothers who are Unitarian use a lot of different sources in their preaching, right? They don't just use scripture, which is a different thing for me. And so for me to push, I might be pushing them toward, if I were working with a Unitarian group, I might be pushing them to have a little more precision and a little more structure with the text than I might with a group that's used to using it a lot.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, that makes sense.
And that's also the job of doctrine. You know, we trust the rest of the liturgy to also provide some structure and some boundaries, not just the preaching moment.
Yeah, that's good. And you live in Atlanta, correct?
Yes, I do.
So in Atlanta, there is what I've heard is like the second largest church in all of America. You want to guess what it is?
You tell me.
Okay, I will. It's North Point. So Andy Stanley, the church that he started, and he's the pastor of this church. And it's this massive church. And one of the things that you find is that, and I'm not picking on Andy Stanley, I think he's a great communicator. You look at what people are taught in homiletics classes and what they learn in seminary, and then you see what a lot of pastors at churches that have a lot of people showing up and a lot of people connecting are doing, and they don't always seem to go together. How does that make you feel as a professor of homiletics to see what the majority of people probably in your town and your country are listening to is not the style of preaching and the understanding of preaching that has been like taught in seminaries?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I would say that anything that happens in my classrooms is just a jumping off point. I'm assuming that all of my students are going to take whatever it is that they've learned in seminary and adapt it to the context in which they are, which I think is what Andy Stanley has done. He's obviously been an innovator and figured out how to work a different style in order in the church that he's in. So I would never as a teacher take that personally. I think it's really a fascinating thing to study, to see how things
adapt. What do you kind of gather from that phenomenon as a student of preaching?
I think we're sort of moving then into discussions of what's entertainment and what's teaching.
Hmm.
And
is that kind of your impression that there's a lot of entertainment that goes on?
Well, he's obviously figured out some ways to hold people in ways that feel familiar to them. He's adapted some techniques from the culture.
Do you think that undermines the text or
I would
the
never
preaching
say
act?
That. I don't make those judgment calls. I think you have to sort of look at each sermon on its own and look at the ministry of a person over time. You know, I think if our preaching makes ourselves the subject, then that's something we need to talk about.
Yeah.
If our preaching makes God the subject, then, I don't want to get in the way of the Spirit in that.
Oh, that's good. Let me tell you a terrible story. I was gone a couple weeks ago. I was traveling, and so someone else was leading the small group. I'm sorry, I have a small group, but a small group that meets in my house.
I am good with your small group.
Oh, that's right. We're good about small groups.
We're good with small groups.
And so,
I'm in a small group.
Good?
I have a small group meeting when I get home tonight.
Yes. And so there's a question that was based off a Barbara Brown Taylor quote, and someone said, who's Barbara Brown Taylor? True or false, the correct response to that is excommunication.
False. I'll just give you false. Although I'll tell you a story. She's a friend, and we got our chickens from her.
Did you really?
We did.
Can I tell you a story about her?
Yeah.
I was emailing with her last month, and we went back and forth. And I did something I'm really embarrassed of. I uh, I I quoted her to her. I didn't mean to.
I'm sure you weren't the first.
It just slipped out. I was like, oh, unsend. And
she's a lovely person.
Tell her I said hi.
She took that.
Okay.
Hi.
All right. Thank you for your time. I appreciate
Thank
your
you.
Being a good sport.
It's been fun.
All right. Thank you all. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for checking out Newsworthy with Norsworthy. Make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You are now adjourned.